As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
The Athletic.
Hello, welcome to the Ornstein and Chapman pod on The Athletic. As well as David today, I'm joined by The Athletic's Adam Crafton and one of our Everton writers, Patrick Boylan. We'll talk Everton, of course, plus David has an update of United's pursuit of Jadon Sancho and also why the injury to Jack Grealish could change the way clubs let players and staff play Fantasy Premier League. Don't forget, until February the 25th, new subscribers can get half-price annual subscription to The Athletic. So that works out at less than £1 a week for an entire year. Just go to theathletic.com/Ornstein and Chapman. If you are a subscriber, you'll be able to read David's column in full each week. David, you got an update this week on Manchester. Oh, good. Haven't done this for at least 2 weeks. Manchester United and Jadon Sancho.
Sancho's back on the pod, yeah. Our latest information is that Manchester United have essentially paused their pursuit of Jadon Sancho for now. There's been a bit of a change in dynamic, and that largely relates to the continued rise of Mason Greenwood, who's now into his second sort of full season in the Manchester United setup. He's been rewarded with a contract extension just last week. And I think that makes the need for Sancho slightly less pressing. Now, he can Greenwood play in multiple positions, and therefore I don't think Sancho's going to be ruled out, especially if Manchester United in this economic climate could cut a much better deal for Sancho next summer than they could last summer. He'll obviously be a year closer to the end of his contract, which expires in 2023. I think in normal circumstances, there would have been a good chance of that happening this summer. I think the expectation from his end is that he will leave Dortmund in this transfer window. And many of us did expect it to happen this time round. But yeah, my latest information is that they've slightly cooled their interest in him. I think their priorities will be other positions, Manchester United. They did bring in two young wingers, of course, not at Sancho's level, over the last year in Pelistri and Diallo. Diallo now with them, Pelistri being loaned out. And I think, or from people I speak to, the sort of focus is more around the striker position and or centre-back. Now, if at the time they decide to go for, let's just say, for example, the centre-back at great expense, then especially in this COVID-affected market, they then may look to go for a developing striker in the other position. Or when the time comes, they say, no, it's all on a striker, Erling Haaland or someone. They then may turn around and look for a more developing player in the centre-back position. And there may be other positions as well. They may go for Sancho ultimately. What I don't think United will do will bring in three players for 70, 90 million. Yes, Ole Gunnar Solskjaer said over the weekend that he feels backed by the ownership in the transfer market. And that inevitably is going to lead to a big deal. But I don't think there are going to be an array of big deals. And so they might have to be creative with what they do. But certainly they're working on plans for the summer. And right now, that doesn't sort of focus intensively on Jadon Sancho.
They need a modern day Paul Warhurst. That's what they need if they're looking for a striker and a centre half. The thing is, Adam, as well, I mean, I know they've signed these two young wingers that David mentioned. They've also got a lot of under 23 players that they are very excited about, particularly in attacking roles I mean, they've got a young centre-half that they're very excited about in Tedem Mendy, who we've spoken about on the pod before. But all of a sudden, their under-23 offering is within the club is making them very excited and has probably made them reassess the positions they need to actually buy.
Yeah, there's the forward Hugill as well, who's done well in the past few weeks. But Ole Gunnar Solskjaer is trying to turn a team from being second, third into being the best in England and Europe. And that means that they're going to have to spend some money and they need, you know, I think people who have watched United closely this season feel that they need a fast centre-half. They need a midfielder who can both win the ball and pass the ball rather than one who does one or the other, which is what a lot of the ones that they do have seem to be. They need a striker to spare us Anthony Martial playing too much more in the number nine position. I think that right wing position was very much a priority last summer, but I think it just feels like other flaws have exposed themselves over the course of this season that have maybe overtaken it to a certain extent. So if you're going to go and spend 70 million on a position, I wouldn't put that as the absolute number one priority at the moment. And, you know, they've also got Dan James doing well. You've got Diallo, you've got Greenwood. I suppose the only thing is there's been quite a lot of big games this season where it's looked like an awkward fit in that right wing position. You had Pogba playing there, I think, against Liverpool. You've had Rashford, who prefers to be on the left, on the right in certain games. So I can understand why they want someone in that position, but it wouldn't, to me, be the, you know, number one, two or three priority this summer.
I think it was quite interesting. I sat in on Everton's general meeting in January and there was a presentation about the summer window and the impact of COVID on the market, not necessarily the Premier League market, which held up pretty well with regards to spending, but I think it's down 40%, 50% in Bundesliga and La Liga. And they're obviously key selling markets for Premier League clubs. So I do wonder if there comes a time where you almost need to reassess priorities and you almost tailor your strategy in the market with regards to incomings around what's happening elsewhere. And then maybe that's where priorities and kind of prioritising certain positions comes to the fore. I mean, Manchester United have got Rashford and Martial, both who are, in my opinion, slightly better from the side with a bit more space. Diallo looks really, really exciting. Probably should be a good signing over the coming seasons. So if you have a budget of X amount, whether it be 100 or £200 million, and you have to focus in on a number of priorities, do you pick either flank for Manchester United at the moment? I mean, I certainly wouldn't from the outside looking in. And I think that's something that's going to more or less ring true for just about every football club as a strategy this summer. Everton themselves will need to do that. They'll need to prioritise 2-3 key positions and maybe make signings there as opposed to what we saw in the past, which was slightly kind of less discriminate spending. So I think we need to bear in mind that clubs are going to have to prioritise, and that might mean that the shopping list is slightly smaller than it would have been in previous windows.
Okay, let's move on. We will talk Jack Grealish and Fantasy Premier League a little bit later, but let's move on to Everton next and their win at Anfield at the weekend.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Well, the biggest story from the weekend was Everton finally winning at Anfield. I suppose, Paddy, the win means you have to do a lot more work than if it had just been another defeat or a draw.
Yeah, I mean, it's only a story really, isn't it, if Everton go to Anfield and win, given how long it's been since they actually managed to achieve that feat. We've, I think, grown a little bit tired of hearing that 1999 date, and I think Kevin Campbell, Everton's goal scorer in that last win, must have grown equally tired of telling the story every single year. Kind of, is this the year that Everton end that Anfield hoodoo? But it's finally over. It means that we have to snap at it. We have to kind of go and tell that story, how it finally came about. And I guess all you can hope is that at some point down the line, that's no longer as big a story from an Everton perspective, but the inside story of Everton's win is no longer as much of a thing because they do it more regularly.
So when you wrote the inside story of Everton's win, what stood out to you about the build-up to it that maybe helped them?
One of the most interesting things for me was just that calm assurance from Carlo Ancelotti. While others, quite rightly, arousing people in the dressing room, people like Duncan Ferguson, the assistant manager, Ancelotti is that kind of sedate figure of calm, and he's making sure that he's getting across those kind of quite intricate tactical messages. Every week for pretty much the last month now, the team sheet has come out an hour before the game, and people like myself have been kind of scratching our heads as to what Everton were actually going to do, such is the nature of the versatility in the squad at this moment in time. But when you saw what he was doing, and effectively this idea of moving towards a man-marking system on certain Liverpool players, Seamus Coleman tracking the run of Andy Robertson, for example, which I thought was a really smart move, you see just how quickly Ancelotti adapts, not only from game to game, but also in-game. It's been quite a while, if we're being honest, since Everton have had a manager that's able to do something like that. And then obviously, great story with the scenes in the dressing room afterwards as well. What did make me chuckle, I have to be honest, is the fact that he had his celebration, Ancelotti, and then he went home to his house on the coast, on the Sefton coast in Crosby, and had a really quiet night with his family. It was almost as though everybody else, it's carnage for everybody else. Everybody else will be made up. But for me, this is just any normal day. And actually, it's just 3 points. And I thought that summed it all up pretty well, to be honest.
Do you think, you talk about his tactical flexibility and you talk about how he changes things in games. Do you think, therefore, there is a greater, I'll bring Adam in on this as well, greater understanding from Everton fans that for as well that they are doing, they are still, to use the horrible word, in transition a little bit. And therefore, you will get a Fulham at home performance mixed in with a win at Anfield performance.
Yeah, I think so. We all know that Ancelotti does like to chop and change. He's not dogmatic. He'll go the other way. He'll be very pragmatic. And what that means sometimes is that because the team is changing so much week to week, it's almost hard to drum up a level of consistency. And when things go wrong, the inevitable question is, what is actually the identity of this football club? But what I'd do is I'd flip that on its head. And what I've seen recently, certainly in the last 10 years at Anfield, managers like Marco Silva and Roberto Martinez going to Liverpool and choosing to set up in their own way, not making any compromise whatsoever, and playing, let's be honest, these kind of high lines against players like Mohamed Salah, Sadio Mane, various other kind of key Liverpool players, and just getting absolutely rinsed in behind. And for Everton fans to know that somebody is going to be flexible and is going to almost look to negate the weaknesses of this side, but also negate the strengths of the other team, I think is very, very important. And yeah, he's obviously he's found a way of, in the big games this season, negating and getting stuff out of games that you probably wouldn't have expected Everton to do. What I would say is the next step for this Everton side, if they're going to go from kind of 6th, 7th, 8th in the table and being so good away from home, depriving opposition sides of space and being pretty reactive, if we're being honest, is when they change and they go more on the front foot, they need to learn how to dominate better. They need to have more players in the midfield who can pass a ball, manipulate possession. I still think we see it as a work in progress, but because there's a lot of happiness with how Ancelotti has been so far, a lot of praise for his start so far among the fan base, I think they are prepared to give him a little bit more time than they would do with others. And that means that these teething problems, they don't get swept under the table, but people accept them a little bit more than they would have done so before.
That identity balance, I always find really interesting, Adam. I was talking to someone in Rugby Union about Harlequins, and Phil Gustard had come in to be the Quins head coach, and he's now left. They were sort of quite critical of someone coming in and going, this is the identity that I believe in, and this is how we're going to play, without necessarily respecting the identity of a club that's been around there, according to the players, that's been around there for decades or a century or whatever. And Ancelotti seems to have that perfect balance at the moment of things will be done his way, but he respects the history and the identity of the club.
Yeah, and I think if you go through Ancelotti's career, you can't really like pinpoint this is the way an Ancelotti team plays. We know Ancelotti teams tend to win things, and that's almost the identity that, you know, they'll play some decent football, they'll get stuck in when they need to, but they're quite civil servant-y in that they're able to adapt to whatever he thinks is the best way to fit the system of whoever's the minister of the minister at the time. And that's, I think that's probably the most effective way of managing football clubs. You know, unless you're Pep Guardiola or Marcelo Bielsa, that's the most effective way of working. I mean, to go on Paddy's point, I thought Everton were good on Saturday. I thought there was two key things. One was that they scored the first goal. And the second is, it's the easiest fixture in English football at the moment, Anfield away. And it's ridiculous to say it. They've lost sight of themselves completely. And that's, I don't mean that to play down Everton's, you know, and the magnitude of what that does to the confidence and things like that. Because, you know, you say it's nearly March, FA Cup quarterfinal, still in the race for the top four. I think there's a long way to go for this Ancelotti Everton team in terms of developing a style, developing a level of confidence that means they can, as Paddy says, not just survive those games and ride out those games, but dominate those games. But what they've got this year, because of how weird this Premier League is, they've got a chance to get in the Champions League. And if you get in the Champions League, you can sign better players. And I know they've already signed some, you know, players like James Rodriguez, but you know, you look at him and he's not someone who was, his star wasn't rising when they signed him. What they have the opportunity this summer, if they get into that fourth space, is we can not only sign those players who are maybe coming to the end, who need an opportunity, but we can actually really then go and attract young, hungry players, you know, players like Dominic Calvert-Lewin, Richarlison, on a broader basis. And I think that's what the opportunity is now for Everton.
Adam, talking about the recruitment there, I'd really like to put a question to Paddy about what is going on with Marcel Brands. You've written about it. He's a very highly respected technical director within football. His contract is coming towards an end at Everton. We still don't have any definitive answer on what's happening. It seems like the deal is close, but not over the line. There's a lot of speculation around Everton about how much power he actually has because of the board, because of Farhad Moshiri, the sort of power at the top level compared to the power on the football side. We know he has a great relationship with Carlo Ancelotti. We know that he would be sought after if he wasn't at Everton. So what is going to happen?
As you've alluded to there, David, a contract now has been put in front of Marcel Brands that came shortly after the new year. And up to that point, there had been a lot of speculation over Brands' future. He's out of contract at the end of the season. There were a few bitty rumours linking him with Manchester United, among others. For Brands, all he's wanted is some kind of clarity over his future. He wanted that offer to be forthcoming. And while Everton were relaxed about the situation because of that, it was very much then a question of putting terms in front of him. I think from the point at which they did that, as long as the terms weren't risible, he was always likely to be of a mind to extend his stay at Goodison Park. You look at his track record, certainly the amount of time he stuck at PSV Eindhoven and the work he did there. For him, it's not about a 2 or 3 year project. It's very much 5, 6, 7, 10 years building a legacy. And I also think we talk about recruitment. There's a bit of a simplification with regards to Brands, because the director of football role at Everton is not purely about signing players and moving others out. For Brands, it's about reforming the academy. It's also about financially making sure the club is on an even keel. These are really important issues. I think as Adam's mentioned there, you can't just sign players that are 29 and 30 and on the way down from a Real Madrid or Barcelona. There has to be something the other way as well, people pushing up. The other way, a lot of Everton's best signings have been Calvert-Lewin, Mason Holgate, for a relative pittance in the modern market. It's important that Brands is, as we believe, soon likely to extend his stay. And then I think it's very much a case, given what we've spoken about with regards to what needs to happen next, developing more of an identity on the pitch, very important that they get to work on the summer now, because there's a window of opportunity this season, but we don't know if that same window of opportunity will be there next, given the kind of relative constraints of COVID and what that's meant for this year.
Are they excited about the new stadium? Or is there a sense of, because we've seen new stadia in the past then become a bit of a burden for a club in the early years that they move there? I'm not saying, not necessarily just talking about on the field and getting used to it. I'm talking about financially as well. And all of a sudden, it sort of affects on-field plans because they're financing this new stadium. Whilst it's exciting and it looks great, and if they get it right, that's brilliant. In the short term, are there any concerns it might cause them a bit of pain?
I think they are excited to an extent, and they'll be even more excited when that is officially signed off from kind of local government and also national government. But I think as well as excitement, it's also about the necessity of it for Everton Football Club and the model moving forward. Obviously, Farhad Moshiri is a very wealthy man. He's a billionaire. But to suggest that he can just continue to plough funds in unrelented at Everton Football Club, it's not really understanding the situation. Obviously, they've lost a lot of money now in successive sets of accounts, hundred millions of pounds. And I think the stadium is seen not as the one-stop shop with regards to a fix. It's not the quick fix, but it's something that can help the club be more sustainable in the future. So I think it's excitement, but there's also a realism. It's like, this has to happen. It's kind of important, not only for the short-term and mid-term security of the club, but long-term too. It's a necessity, and that's it.
Andy, can I pick up on one of your points about recruitment? Is Jarrod Branthwaite the kind of archetypal signing that Everton are going to look to go to, obviously supplement the bigger star name players? I've seen him linked with a move already away from Everton because he's so highly rated. He's out on loan, of course. And also, Adam, I don't know if you have any wider views on whether clubs like Everton are really now scouring the domestic market for a Branthwaite-type signing because of the new regulations that have come in around the post-Brexit rules.
On Branthwaite, I think that's where Brands really comes into his own. That's the archetypal Marcel Brands signing. I don't actually think when you look at Alan or James Rodriguez, they're not necessarily the players that he himself would be shortlisting if he was given sole 100% power over Everton transfers. And I also think that if Carlo Ancelotti hadn't been at Everton, it would have been much harder for Everton to even attract Alan and James in the first place, given the position in the league table last season, which was 12th. What Brands likes to do, and we saw this at PSV, is improve the academy, but also find the next young thing, the players that might not necessarily be first team players in the short term, but in 2-3 seasons can really push on and give the manager new options. I think that's vitally important. He's already done it a few times, but Ancelotti's focus is very much going to be on success in the next 2-3 seasons, improving Everton, getting them into Europe, and then hopefully pushing them on beyond that, winning silverware. Brands, as I signed Branthwaite, his recruitment structure unearthed Niels Nkunku, who was playing in Marseille B, had never played a competitive match for Marseille's first team. And both of those players have really impressed when they were given the opportunity. That's where I think you see the value of somebody like Marcel Brands more than ever. So I still expect that there to be a dual-pronged approach. It's not always easy to iron out some of the creases, given that you've got slightly competing forces. There's that focus on pushing on in the very short term on the pitch, but there's also safeguarding the long-term future of the club. That is a little bit of a fault line, but they've got figures in place. If they allow Brands to focus more in that kind of unearthing talent side of things, and he then helps Ancelotti identifying targets for the first team, I think that's the best way forward for Everton in the current structure. And that's what means that they're able to have a Branthwaite while also signing James Rodriguez.
Everton have always been good, haven't they, at recruiting young, smart talent from the lower divisions. You know, you look at Mason Holgate and Dominic Calvert-Lewin, and, you know, going back to John Stones a few years ago as well. So I think that's something that Everton have always been across. And I think what's good is that it finally seems under the Moshiri ownership that there seems to be a respect for the traditions of the club while also having a healthy ambition to move the club forwards. And I think maybe in those first couple of years, it was all a bit like, we want to get there, and we want to get there at 1 million miles per hour, and nothing's going to stand in our way. And I think now they're just pacing it a bit more smartly. What is interesting is, I think that, am I right in thinking the new stadium would be due to open 2024-25?
They're talking about once planning permission is granted, and hopefully that'll be in the next few weeks, or certainly in the next few months, it would be 150 weeks as a rough estimate for the construction. So that's 24-25, as you point out.
Working on that basis, I think what's interesting is we have these proposed Champions League changes that would come in 2024. And, you know, if you speak to people at the Premier League at the moment, their big concern is, can they make what they consider at the moment to be a big six into a big eight or a big nine by the time those Champions League changes come around? And I think, you know, you look at teams such as Everton, Leeds, maybe Wolves, Aston Villa, Leicester, and you look at the drop off from teams such as Arsenal and Tottenham,
West Ham,
of course,
just to stop any abuse coming your way from West Ham fans, and then you're probably done. Then you're all right. You've covered yourself.
There's 10 teams that have the potential in terms of infrastructure and budget and that kind of thing to be around those 10 places in whichever order they are for the next few years. And that's important for the Premier League because it helps them to push back against this idea that you're always going to have the same teams going into the Champions League. So Everton have to play a big part of that. But if they're then thinking on the other side, we need to pay for this stadium, I wonder how much that could in time limit their ambitions. And I know everyone always says, no, it'll be a land of opportunity. That's what Tottenham said. That's what West Ham said. That's what Arsenal said. It always works out a bit harder than that. That'd just be the concern. But that's not really Everton's fault. That's just the way football is progressing at this moment in time.
That's a really interesting point on the Champions League going forward and what the Premier League might want. Do you think, and I'm probably asking you to guess here, for their argument, for their purpose going forward, the Premier League would quite like Leicester and West Ham to finish in the top four this season, if possible, or Everton?
I think there are people at the Premier League who would find it extremely funny if, you know, after a year in which you've had things such as Project Big Picture, threats of breakaways and Super Leagues and all that kind of thing, if you then get Leicester, West Ham or Everton, you know, two of those teams going into the top four, I think there are people across English football that would find that very funny because you have six teams who have declared themselves the rulers of English football based, and they have grounds in terms of, you know, the interest that they drive, the revenue that they drive, saying that they want a bigger slice of that. But then it's a bit like, okay, well, go and produce a team that's capable of backing up what you say. And at the moment, Tottenham aren't doing that. Arsenal certainly aren't doing that. Liverpool aren't doing that this season. Chelsea are barely doing it. And Manchester United are sort of doing it. So, you know, I think that's why this season is such an interesting possibility, because if you get a Leicester or an Everton or West Ham going into those places, it just solidifies their voice at the table that little bit more. It means that, you know, Karen Brady, for example, her voice at that table becomes a little bit more important because she then starts going to meetings at the European Clubs Association and things like that. So I think I'm wary of, you know, we've seen years, haven't we, where Everton went into the Champions League and it didn't work out in 2005, and Leicester went in and it sort of dropped out since then. But this season is an interesting one for that reason.
Adam, are these clubs actually overtaking the likes of Tottenham and Arsenal on a permanent basis? And if so, how on earth have those so-called bigger clubs allowed the likes of Everton, West Ham to zoom past them? And to the point where it's now looking like it's becoming quite established.
My sort of lighthearted answer to this is, like, no matter how rich men are, men will always mess up at some point. And I think that's what's happened. You know, all the cards were stacked in the favour of those six clubs. They had the most money, they had the best players, they had the best coaches, and they've still found a way to mess it up. I think on that level, that's what's happened. On the other hand, I don't think it's a permanent shift, because they still have these revenues and they still have the infrastructure and they still have the best academies and they still have the broader scouting networks. So, you know, are we to expect for the next 10 years that Leicester will, on average, finish higher than Arsenal and Tottenham? I would be amazed, because the revenues and the budgets and the infrastructure say that shouldn't happen. If they do, it's of huge credit to a Leicester or a Leeds, because it will mean they are doing their job so much better. Arsenal, I think, is the really interesting one at the moment, because, you know, we're looking at really chronic underperformance over several years. And we're now seeing a level of patience and tolerance being afforded to a head coach that is, in many ways, to be admired, but in other ways, is completely unparalleled for one of those big six clubs. That I can't remember another case where you've had a team that has shown, you know, so little, where so much patience and tolerance and indulgence has been shown to the head coach. And, you know, I hope in time that that's proven to be a really good decision, but let's see where that goes.
Do Everton feel like they have a voice, Patrick?
I think they do, and they're not normally a club that kind of throws the pots and pans out. They don't stomp around, and they certainly don't kind of aggressively kind of look to kind of encircle themselves and kind of intertwine themselves with the media. That's not the way they've ever worked, really, Everton Football Club. I think what they have done is they've gone about their business quietly. They've been forceful in their objections in private, in Premier League meetings, particularly through Denise Barrett-Baxendale, the CEO of the club. Very outspoken in those meetings, we believe, with regards to Project Big Picture in particular, but also helping with Project Restart and being one of the main drivers behind, catalysts behind that. So I think they do feel as though they have a voice, but I think influence, and Adam's kind of mentioned this a little bit, is influence is very much tied to success and stature. And I think if Everton are going to have that voice long term, then they need to back it up with league positions, tangible success on the pitch. Going back to those clubs you mentioned there, the supposed big six, I think what they've done over the years means that they do have a seat at the table, and they are able to, because of their infrastructure and their success, they are able to dictate, and there's gravitas there. Everton now have Carlo Ancelotti, and their aim very much through Mashiri's funds, the new stadium, Carlo Ancelotti, is to ensure that the conditions are in place, them to have more of a discussion, an increasingly large discussion and increasingly large piece of the pie as we continue down the road. So I agree with Adam. I think it's very much, I think it's the infrastructure of the club that shows how a side is going to do over 5-10 year period. And you may have these anomalies in the short term. If Tottenham or an Arsenal makes bad decisions and a Leicester or an Everton makes very good decisions, what Everton are banking on, and I think Leicester too, is that what they're able to do is to breach the gap and narrow it because of success on the pitch, and to do so in the short term, and then commercially they catch up, then they have a bigger piece of the pie, and they have a more of a say at meetings. But it's very much a work in progress, I think, at this stage in time.
Of all of these clubs, if West Ham make the Champions League, they're offering decent bonuses to their players?
Well, for a start, I think West Ham players will just be absolutely delighted with how things are going from a football perspective. And every time I speak to people there about what money's on offer, they say, these guys are only in it for the sporting success. But we know there's another side to this as well. And yes, we reveal in my Monday column that West Ham's collective bonuses start from a 9th place finish. They do not get anything as a collective group between 10th and 20th. But from 9th, it kicks in, and then it ratchets up per position. And obviously, they then get into European territory. But there's an enormous leap if they were to qualify for the Champions League, finish in the top four, of a figure to share between them of approaching £10 million. So it's not a bespoke Champions League bonus. It's just there's a massive climb in their bonus scheme if they were to get there. And that might be an added sweetener incentive for them maintaining the position that they're in now, which is 4th.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
I know your expertise is Everton, but can you, you're the only one, I think, of us that plays FPL. So can you stay with us just to help us through the mechanics of this?
Of course, yeah.
Thanks.
You can try to explain.
It's either that or I go and grab my son down from his homeschooling, and I think I better leave him to do that. Because this all centres around, David, Jack Grealish getting injured at the back end of last week, but Villa players on Friday taking him out of their fantasy Premier League teams.
I think it was Thursday, Friday, when some rumours started to circulate that Jack Grealish had an injury, and we didn't know why that was, although we were hearing similar things. But it emerged that that came from Aston Villa players and staff whose fantasy Premier League identities are known about by some members of the public, or FPL Insider, I think it's called on Twitter. They transferred Grealish out of their team ahead of the weekend's game against Leicester. And that sort of set alight the speculation that Grealish was suffering from an injury. He indeed did miss that match, and it seems that he could be out for longer. Dean Smith said in his press conference that, you know, he's going to find the source of this leak, but it appears he only needs to look closer to home, or if he wants to read our column, it's all explained in there. On the same weekend, I think Leeds captain Liam Cooper transferred out Alioski from his team, and that was spotted and got tongues wagging. And indeed, Alioski did not play for the first time in about 18, 19 games. And we understand that clubs, without sort of major alarm, are onto this. And there is an element of concern, because essentially their team news is being leaked innocently, really, by accident, by people within their own camp playing FPL. And it's even been spoken about at board level among some clubs on what they can do about this. And I think it may be a case of telling their players and staff not to pick their own teams, or just keeping everything a bit more private, or just not getting involved in it at all. But now I'm going to hand over to my learned friend.
What I would say is that it's quite easy now to find Premier League players on fantasy football and to look at their teams, and then obviously they pick and choose players from their own club. Sometimes they pick themselves, which is strange, but that's sometimes they pick themselves. As you've mentioned there, you've got kind of club staff transferring players in and out, and what that means is that you get a very early indication a day or two before a game. In some cases, as David's column rightly points out, very early indications as to team news. If this had been leaked to the media by kind of a member of the backroom staff, if we were getting team news leaked to us that way, then obviously clubs would be up in arms. And while I think this is slightly more innocent, as David says, they're still going to be very mindful of the fact that a Leicester or whoever it may be will find out that Jack Grealish is not playing a day or two before the game, and it's effectively being confirmed innocently by a club physio. That's probably the start, I think, of a slope that leads to players either not playing fantasy Premier League at all, or not being allowed to have any players from their club side in their own team, which is, it's mad.
I don't know how you police that, really, to be honest with you. And I mean, I'm assuming you can make a different name up and you don't have to reveal your identity with a fancy league team, do you? By your email to the organisers?
No, you sign up with an email account. So, like you say, very, very difficult to police. It's the same with gambling, of course. You may well have a situation, you do have a situation where even club ambassadors, for example, aren't technically allowed to bet on their side's fortunes from week to week, but much, much harder in reality to police that. So you can have the guideline in place. You can tell people what they should be doing, but actually enforcing that is another matter entirely. So person X, who is a physio at club Y, may decide to come up with a completely new name. He might be Benjamin Button or the Great Gatsby or whoever for the purposes of FPL. And I don't necessarily think there's much you can do about that. But like we say, clubs aren't going to allow that to stand for much longer if, in the example of Grealish, Leicester are finding out about his lack of availability of kind of 48 hours before kickoff.
The way this goes, Adam, I just envisage a new role being created within clubs' analytics departments to go through opposition players' fancy football teams in the week leading up to their game. There'll be a role for this somewhere, I guarantee it.
Well, I was just imagining what Marcelo Bielsa, just holding a meeting this morning, saying, which one of you wants to do this for the next couple of years? And it'll be all sorts of coding going on, working out every player's fantasy team. It's just very funny, isn't it, really? I'm trying to sort of make a serious point about it, but in essence, it's just players being a bit daft and not realizing, you know, or physios or whoever it is, being a bit daft and not realizing, oh my God, I've just given away quite a big secret for 2 days' time. And it's one of it's just one of those that I imagine there may be like some sort of provision where the fantasy Premier League site can just make, I suppose, more private settings for players who wish to be involved. So I don't think they would want to lose them and lose that interest that it clearly drives, because it's something that's so often spoken about annoyingly on socials and in talk shows and all that kind of thing. It's a big topic of conversation. So I don't think they'll want to lose professional players from the system. So they'll just have to make provisions to make it more watertight for them.
Let's leave it there then. Thank you everybody for listening. Thank you everybody for being on the pod. I'm back on Thursday alongside Matt for the Business of Sport podcast, and look out for the latest episode of David's YouTube video series, Ask Ornstein. That's on Wednesday. Bye from us.
The Athletic.